Beer, Cheese, and Murder is a true crime podcast about Wisconsin from Wisconsin. Due to the nature of true crime, this podcast contains explicit and graphic content which may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. I'm Erica, and joining me today, I have
Bonnie,
Dina B,
Jill,
and Kayla Z.
Terry is down with a cold, so it's just the five of us today. All right.
Feel better soon, Terry.
It's that time of year. I feel like when the seasons start to change, that's when illnesses seem to take root. All right, so today I am highlighting, I'll just jump into my food and beverage for today. So and this will be in the Instagram post as well for anybody that is following us on Instagram, and if you're not, you should start at Beer, Cheese, and Murder Pod. So I'm drinking a Scani Smash.
It looks delish just so by the can.
Yeah. And it's very much Wisconsin just by the name. But so this is classified as a fruit beer, but I will tell you that it very much tastes more like a wine cooler. It's like very fruity. You really can't.
Really?
Yeah, it's really sweet. It's a, let's see. It is from the Wisconsin Dells Brewing Company out of Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. And actually, when I looked it up, I was kind of pleasantly surprised that it's actually Moose Jaw. So one of the
popular... I would have thought it was Madison.
Yeah, you'd think, right? But so like that Moose Jaw pizza is a popular spot to stop in the Dells for like pizza. And it's actually Moose Jaw Pizza and Wisconsin Dells like Brewing Company. So it's the same company apparently that brews the beer, so I found that interesting. But anyway, it's a fairly light on the ABV. It's about 4.2%, and it is a smash up of Wisconsin cranberries with sweet and tart cherries. It's light and sweet with a bright red color.
I love it. Scani Smash, that's cool. Now that, see, that makes me want to try that one.
Yeah, same. If it tastes like
normally
a wine,
I wouldn't buy.
It does, yeah. It really like does. Which means it's going to go down really quick and easy.
If you get a chance to stop talking.
Right. But yeah, that's the danger of those types of beverages. Is they don't taste like alcohol, so they go down way too fast. But that's where it's, at least it's not too heavy in terms of ABV, so it shouldn't be too bad. But yeah, no, Sean actually found that at Total Wine. He had it as a six pack. It might be more seasonal. I'm not 100% sure because I had a hard time finding it when I went back to get some more. But one thing that's really nice about Total Wine is that you can go to like their craft beer area and you can make your own six pack. So it's a great way to try out a bunch of different types of beer, a bunch of different types of breweries, and really get a good variety. And so for this type of platform where we're trying to highlight different beers and different breweries across the state, it's almost overwhelming the options, but it's a great way to go and pick a bunch of different stuff. So,
well, and that is cool because then you're not stuck with six beers that you may not even like. This way you can be like, okay, I liked this one, I'm gonna go back and get more. Okay, this one not so much.
Because Sean's taste in beer are very different than mine, so if I don't like it, chances of him drinking it are slim. So can't pawn it off on him. But this is actually this is actually a very good one. So this is a Scani Smash. And then to pair with that, I have the good old Wisconsin sushi that was introduced to myself and the podcast by Dina.
Love it.
So to make it as Wisconsin as possible, I made it with some Badger baked ham with some cream cheese and then the Milwaukee petite baby dill pickles. So tried to add in as much Wisconsin flair as possible. And then as you'll see in the Instagram photo, I'm got some chopsticks. So
that cracked me up. That picture, like just picture it, the name Wisconsin sushi.
Yeah. Like,
and then picturing you putting one of those, the pickle thing in your mouth with a chopstick, that just kind of cracks me up.
Well, and with that cream cheese, it's a little messy. So I feel like I need to play around with that some more. But I mean, it's nice having the chopsticks. You don't get cream cheese all over your fingers.
I always have to dry the ham with a paper towel because otherwise the cream cheese just slides right off.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you got to dry the pickle to roll it as well. It's very messy to make it, but they're very yummy even when they're messy.
So good.
Yeah. You have the traditional bamboo roller for making the sushi.
Right. I totally should.
If you guys want to know a weird trick, if you have like a placemat, like a firm placemat, mm-hmm. you can use like just clean it off and you can use that to roll your sushi. That's pretty much what the bamboo mat does. Yeah.
I think it helps having the sticky rice though. So that is something we do not.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. All right, are you guys ready to jump into the Wisco fact?
Absolutely.
Ready.
All right. So our fact for this episode or for today is the Wisconsin idea. So according to Wikipedia on the University of Wisconsin-Madison, research, teaching, and service at the UW is influenced by a tradition known as the Wisconsin idea. First articulated by UW-Madison President Charles Van Hise in 1904, when he declared, "I shall never be content until the
benevolent."
Well, it says this is a word that I don't think is often used anymore. Okay, so "I shall never be content until the beneficent influence of the university reaches every home in the state." The Wisconsin idea holds that the boundaries of the university should be the boundaries of the state, and that the research conducted at UW-Madison should be applied to solve problems and improve health, quality of life, the environment, and agriculture for all citizens of the state. The Wisconsin idea permeates the university's work and helps forge close working relationships among university faculty and students and the state's industries and government. Based on Wisconsin's populist history, the Wisconsin idea continues to inspire the work of the faculty, staff, and students who aim to solve real-world problems by working together across disciplines and demographics. So, it's kind of cool.
Never heard of the Wisconsin idea.
If he coined it, you know, back in 1904, it's over 100 years old, which is why that word threw me off. But
some days I feel like I'm 100 years old.
Yeah, but I mean, that is one thing I would say from my time at Madison as an engineering student, I didn't necessarily get as much exposure to the type of research and that type of thing that's done there, but it is something that students very much get involved in, especially from the health side of it. And even in engineering, when you get into the coursework where you're doing like project work, they have the project classes where you have so much classroom time, but then you have expected time outside of it where you're working on a project. They actually coordinate with local companies and communities for project ideas. So, you know, even as a student, you are able to make a real contribution to area businesses and trying to help make improvements and things like that. So it's actually pretty cool. My freshman year, what did we do? We did a project with Easter Seals, which works with disabled children. And we physically built a ADA approved like walk path from like their special like camp building to an ADA playground so that the kids with wheelchairs and things like that would be better able to access the ground. So that's kind of the idea of the Wisconsin idea, that it's not just benefiting yourself, and it's not just benefiting the university, it's the university serves the entire state and the community.
I looked up beneficence, and by no surprise, because it kind of looks like benefit, mm-hmm. and it's the state of doing or producing good, the quality of state of doing or producing good. So
yeah,
I'm going to start using that in sentences.
I was thinking that as well, but I don't know if I can actually say it. Beneficence?
Beneficent.
Yeah, beneficent. It's very much reminds me of Maleficent. So,
and that's the antonym it said.
I was going to say the opposite. Yeah. That's
yeah. True. I know that because of Disney. But somewhat fittingly, the university's motto is Numen Lumen, divine light. So it's kind of cool.
No other Seinfeld watchers here. Numen.
Oh, that was, yeah, Numen.
All right. So after a little lighthearted and positive Wisco fact, are you guys ready for a case?
Yes.
All right. I am. So I, as usual, I selected the Wisco fact accordingly to the location of our case. So today's case takes us back to Madtown, aka Madison, Wisconsin. And more specifically, it takes us to the University of Wisconsin-Madison itself, my alma mater, as I mentioned. And it also takes us back to the year of 2008, when I was actually going to school there. So not only where I went to school, but when I went to school. Based on the timing of this, I was finishing up my sophomore year, because it took place in the spring of 2008.
So did you remember this case?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. This case has actually been on my mind to cover since the concept of this podcast even started. Ah. So this is definitely a case that I knew about and wanted to be able to touch on. And I finally decided the time was right.
Excellent.
Interesting.
So for me personally, campus was a home away from home. It was far enough away that I couldn't just go home whenever I wanted, but it was close enough that I didn't get homesick. It still had that Wisconsin feel, and I wasn't like so far away that if I wanted to see my parents, I could be like, hey, can you guys come up here for the weekend? It wasn't that bad. So, I mean, it was chosen specifically from that standpoint. The city of Madison was far more city than what I was used to and much bigger than my hometown, but I never felt unsafe while I was there.
I never felt unsafe living in Madison either.
Right. And I walked most everywhere, preferring walking to a crowded bus with strangers. So a lot of students will take the bus because you get your bus pass. You could take them more or less for free on campus.
You didn't have a scooter, Erica?
No, I did not. I did at one point in time have a bike. I did have a bike for a period of time, but I preferred to walk. It was good exercise, and I am not a big crowd person, so hopping on a crowded bus was not a big fan of, like, something I was a big fan of, unless it was like freezing cold, and there were definitely some really cold days where you're walking around there. But there's quite a bit of people that walk everywhere. And when you're walking everywhere, because you don't have a car, or maybe you don't have a bike, because it requires some form of being able to get it to campus, and then you got to find somewhere to store it. And let me tell you, if you're living in the dorms, having a car there is like ridiculously expensive, and there's very limited parking. So you really don't usually have a vehicle until you're in the like apartments off campus. So I walked just about everywhere, including walking at night and usually by myself, because everybody's schedule is different and I am a natural introvert. So I kind of am perfectly fine with my own company. And most times of day, there are plenty of foot traffic, as I said, but even in the city of Madison, it dies down at some point. So people do have to sleep, although there's plenty of people pulling all-nighters, that's for sure. So there are plenty of times where the streets are quiet, and I even remember in my senior year, walking by myself down University Avenue from my apartment to the engineering computer lab at around 3 a.m. because I needed to print out a final report for one of my classes.
Oh my gosh.
You don't see me at 3 a.m. unless I haven't gone to bed yet.
Or oh my gosh. I was just going to say you didn't run into Dina stumbling home.
No, I didn't live there in 2008. I already lived in Milwaukee for 12 years. Otherwise, yeah. You might have.
But yeah, I mean, I didn't often, lots of people had often pulled all-nighters. I very rarely pulled all-nighters, but this was one instance where I did pull an all-nighter because I procrastinated big time in doing this final report. And I think there was something wrong with my printer or something. I don't remember, but I definitely had to go to the computer lab to get something printed out. So it had me walking from our apartment down University Avenue by myself at 3 a.m. Mom, don't listen. I mean, nothing happened. It was perfectly fine. I didn't see anybody, but you always have that what if something could have happened. But it's, I felt safe. I wasn't completely unsafe or unaware of my surroundings. And, I had pepper spray. So I had that. I also, in the dorms and even when I was out of the dorms and in apartments, I lived more on the lakeshore side of the city. So it wasn't as densely it's still densely populated, but not as densely populated. I want to say it felt a little bit more safe on the lakeshore side. And, you do have to have that certain amount of common sense, but even being hyper alert and wary of every bush and blind spot wouldn't have saved me from someone bigger and stronger than me. Yep. So, mm-hmm. Walking down the road at 3 a.m. while necessary because I made it necessary may not have been, maybe I got lucky. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I did. And like I said, like many girls, I had my pepper spray, but I was also told that pepper spray wouldn't discriminate. So to use it and run, because in the end, it could have been just as much of a detriment as a savior. If you get hit by that pepper spray, you're going to be just as much knocked out of it as whoever it is that you're trying to fend off. Yeah. Luckily, I never had reason to use it and find out if it would have been a detriment.
I had someone accidentally hit a pepper spray in a college dorm room, and my dorm room was down the hallway, and I started, I had my door shut and I started coughing and my eyes were watering. And then I walked down the hallway and was like, oh my God, what happened?
Wow.
Some guy found it on his friend's keychain, on some girl's keychain, and thought that it was fake and pushed the button, and it pretty much lit up the whole dorm room, but not lit up, but blew up the whole dorm room with, and everyone's eyes were watering and everyone was coughing and they had to evacuate the whole floor pretty much. So yeah. I think it's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And to be honest, I had it, but I would have been too afraid to use it because of that.
Right. Fact. Right. I agree.
It's something that you use if you absolutely positively need to use it,
kind of like the joke when I was in Alaska was we had bear spray, and it's what are the chances you'll be quick enough to be able to use it
right
in yeah. time. But I've got my Bling Sting now, courtesy of Jill, actually, my Bling pepper spray.
That's right. That's right. Don't
forget She Birdie.
She Birdie.
My birdie. Yep. Yeah, the birdie. Birdie.
And Kayla's attack dog.
She just got her pepper spray. So she lost 5 pounds.
I carried pepper spray walking through the parking garages downtown Milwaukee when I worked there for the first couple of years because I was always afraid. There's a lot of creepy people downtown Milwaukee.
Yeah, I just assume there's...
It's just me, Dina, okay? I'm just kidding.
You moved down there to be with your people.
Yeah.
Well, and that's just it. You know, us true crime aficionados, if you will, even being suspicious and looking for danger where danger may not even be lurking isn't going to prevent us from being attacked if somebody is so intent on doing so.
Yep.
And that's scary, but it's reality. So I think that's honestly part of the reason why true crime is so popular, especially for women, is because the idea of knowledge is power, and thinking that being more aware could potentially, and maybe it does help, but in some cases it won't. So also while I was in college, I vaguely recall stories from my freshman year of a girl getting grabbed off of Observatory Drive by someone in a van and being sexually assaulted. But in looking back, to me, it seems more like it was just a story. So I haven't been able to find any news stories to substantiate the rumors and talk that I remember from that time. You know, and perhaps it was more of a cautionary tale to freshman girls to be wary and to be sure to walk in groups. And I think either way, we were more cautious. I definitely remember a period of time where girls were not walking by themselves, at least at night, whether that story was true or not.
That's good.
Yeah. And as my schooling continued, you know, eventually you get so caught up in your own classes and keeping up with the coursework and moving forward that you kind of put those types of stories behind you. So, you know, I was far too busy as things kept going to worry about a possible boogeyman, if you will. That is until a real life boogeyman struck.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun.
Brittany Zimmerman was a 21-year-old student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and by all accounts, her life was just beginning. She was looking forward to graduating and getting her first degree in medical microbiology and immunology, which was a step on the path to becoming a doctor.
This name is familiar. I'm searching my brain.
I'm sure it'll start dinging some bells once we keep going.
Madison case has always caught my attention. So even though I wasn't living there, so I'm sure.
Yeah.
Keep going. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. She was also engaged. So she had a wedding to look forward to as well.
I know which one it is now.
Wow.
Just that part of it. Got it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So many new and wonderful things were on the horizon, and she should have had a wonderfully bright future. Unfortunately, that future was cruelly extinguished on Wednesday, April 2nd, 2008. Around midday, Brittany made her way home after having had a morning exam for one of her classes. Like most upper-level classmen, she lived just off campus in an apartment. She and her fiance, Jordan, lived in a small apartment at 517 West Doty Street, which placed them just off campus to the east, about equal distance between the UW campus and the Capitol building. So I looked it up, and it's about less than a mile to each of those locations in terms of like walking distance. From like their apartment, if she were to walk to the Capitol, less than a mile. If she were to walk from her apartment to the campus, less than a mile. And it would have only been maybe 15 minutes to get there. So pretty populated area, right in the middle of common spaces there. Opposite side of campus from where I lived. And also located close to that apartment was just blocks away was a local police department. So they were very close to a law enforcement location as well.
I also just want to take a pause, and for anyone not from Wisconsin, Madison is Wisconsin's state capital. I think most of my friends out of state think that Milwaukee is our state capital. So just want to, when Erica says the Capitol building, that's because Madison's our state capital.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is the state Capitol building. Yeah.
Madison's a capital, but Milwaukee's a bigger city.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. So they are very close to the state capital, as well as the university. So again, it was the middle of the week, as it was Wednesday. It was the middle of the day. According to wonderground.com, the temperature that day peaked at about 49 degrees Fahrenheit. There was no precipitation and conditions were fair. So it was all in all a pretty nice early spring day. Honestly, better than some of the days we've had recently.
Better than today.
So they were situated smack dab in the midst of a more highly populated area, mostly comprised of students, also walking between classes, home, and other establishments in the area. Surely all of that activity would deter someone with ill intent, but not that day. None of that would save Brittany. Brittany's fiance, Jordan, returned to their apartment and discovered a bloody scene. At 1:08 p.m., he frantically called 911 to report that Brittany had been shot. The scene he walked in on was so bloody that he was actually mistaken in what had happened to Brittany. Brittany's official cause of death was classified as complex homicidal violence. She had multiple sharp force trauma wounds and multiple blunt force trauma blows. Multiple stab wounds had actually penetrated Brittany's heart.
Man.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And based on the wounds, it was estimated that the blade was 2 inches to 5 inches long and 1.5 to 2 centimeters wide. Brittany had everything to live for, and she fought hard. But in the end, she was overpowered by her assailant, and she could not survive the injuries that she sustained in the attack. One of the most controversial points about this case was that it was discovered that before the 911 call made by Jordan at 1:08 p.m., another call to 911 was logged. The call occurred at 12:20 p.m. and was made by Brittany herself, 40 minutes before her body was discovered.
Oh my God.
Wow.
The dispatcher who took the call claimed that they couldn't hear anything, and the call was ultimately disconnected. The reality is far more chilling and heartbreaking.
Now, do we know? I thought nowadays that if 911 is called, that they have to call back to the phone number to like make sure everything is clear.
They're supposed to. Do we know
if that might be why
they didn't? They were supposed to and they didn't.
Oh, okay. So even then they were supposed to.
Yeah. So.
Oh, okay.
So.
Okay. Man, that's terrible.
Yeah, the dispatcher claimed that all they heard was like silence, that no sound was coming through, and then the call ended up being disconnected. And to your point, that dispatcher should have called back, but didn't. When they found out that this call went through, they actually went back because those calls are recorded. So they were able to actually listen to the call to confirm whether or not what the dispatcher claimed was true. And the reality was that while the dispatcher did take the call and ultimately it was disconnected, the saved recording of the call revealed that it was far from silent.
Oh no.
No.
The call started with a woman's scream.
Oh gosh, yeah. I just got chills.
Me too.
And the active line stayed open long enough to capture more screams, gasps, and sounds of a struggle.
Oh my gosh.
And the dispatcher thought that, oh my gosh.
She was obviously having a bad day.
On with this, yeah. Wow.
Brittany's fight for her life was caught on audio tape and no one responded. The dispatcher claimed to hear nothing prior to the call being disconnected and never called back. 911.
Also, like, I know, I feel like nowadays with cell phones, it might be easier to accidentally make an emergency call, because I think sometimes when you like go to shut off your phone or you hold the side button or something, there's an option to like place an emergency call. But back in 2008, if you dial 911, and as long as it's not like a child accidentally calling, like, I feel like you don't just accidentally dial 911.
If there's a scream.
Yeah, this is regardless, very serious.
You have to follow through.
You have to follow through.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
911 would not respond until her fiance would call after making the horrifying discovery of her brutalized body. And as you said, Kayla, like, I know nowadays that technology has advanced exponentially over the last few years, so I'm not sure exactly what or was not technologically capable for tracing the call made. So I don't know if they could have, she called from her cell phone, but I don't know if they could have traced it to the location. I don't know how technology was at that time with like the location tracing.
Yeah, I guess in movies they always just like show up at, like, they know, they ask where you are, but then they just kind of know, but or can pinpoint you.
I think if they had cause to be concerned and she called back, if it made connection to the phone, they might be able to trace it that way with the open connection, the way that they do in old school where you get the person on the phone and have them talk long enough,
like triangulate and whatever,
right? So they might have been able to do something like that if the call connected, but there is definitely protocols either way. So I don't know what was technologically capable specifically at that time, but police did later acknowledge that in this case the police should have been dispatched. The operator neither notified police nor attempted to call the number back. So she basically said she got busy with other calls and just never called back. So she should have at least let somebody know, like, hey, I got a concerning call. It got disconnected. You know, let the police decide whether or not to dispatch people or what. But she never, like, let anybody know that this call even came through or what she heard.
I'm wondering if, did this person lose their job? I mean,
she was allowed to, there's a different article that I found about multiple 911 calls gone bad, this being one of the ones that were shared in that article. And it essentially stated that in this case, the dispatcher was allowed to transfer to another county. So they just moved her to
less
somewhere
busy
else.
County.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
But there are certain protocols that are supposed to be followed. And I think one of those is if a call does get disconnected, they're required to report it. And she never reported the disconnected call. So I don't know if some of these things were in place as protocols and requirements at the time that this happened.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. But I know that this case did cause some definite changes in regulations going forward.
And I know for a fact that I always knew I could never be an air traffic controller, but now add 911 dispatcher to jobs that I would never want to have, because my gosh, this is just so terrifying.
Yeah,
my friend Becky is one, and it's an extremely stressful job.
I hope they give them therapists for
I'm
sure they do. Yeah,
that's got to be like a high burnout type position,
I would think.
Right.
But so not surprisingly, Brittany's family did file a suit against Dane County for negligent handling of the 911 call. And the county did settle with her parents with the official stance that it had complied with all applicable laws and regulations, but believes the settlement is in the public interest as it provides resolution for the family and community and saves further expense of ongoing litigation. So they're basically like, technically we followed the rules, so you can't really get too much out of us, but
we're not going to admit fault.
We're going to put a show of good faith to try and get the public off our back.
Right.
But if you want the details of the settlement, you're gonna, it's all like a slap in the face from my perspective. So the settlement resulted in $5,000 going towards a reward fund to find Brittany's killer and another $2,500 to pay for the family's attorney.
That was the full settlement amount?
That's the settlement?
Yeah.
You got to be shitting.
Shut the hell up. And the family took it.
Instead I don't think they had a choice because if those regulations weren't in place, I think there were changes going forward, but if they technically.
Wow.
And I imagine that as technology has advanced, that the requirements are even stricter than they used to be because they can trace things, I think, a lot more effectively than they could before. But yeah, so that was the settlement, which to me is a major slap in the face.
Seriously.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But as I stated, the most important thing I think coming out of this is that the county made some policy changes to help prevent this type of thing from happening again in the future. So hopefully another family never has to deal with this type of situation.
Yeah, that's a positive.
So in addition to what they could learn from Brittany and the injuries she sustained, the scene of the attack was thoroughly investigated. Evidence suggested that her assailant forcibly broke into the apartment. And there was also DNA evidence collected that investigators believed would connect back to Brittany's killer. Court records show that 7 search warrants were issued and executed in relation to the investigation. The first search warrant was for Zimmerman's apartment at 517 West Doty Street and her fiance's 1999 Volkswagen Golf.
Also, do you know anything about like how many units were in this apartment? Was it an apartment building?
Street is primarily like duplexes and rental properties. Mm-hmm. It's basically houses. Most of Doty Street is houses.
Yeah.
Also, and that's probably a bi or tri-level.
That's exactly what it was. It was a house. I don't know if it was like a duplex or a tri-level, but it was like a house converted into apartments.
Okay. So it was like a house. And also it was, I think you said mid-afternoon. So
right. It was a Wednesday.
May not have heard her scream. And
kids could have been in class. They could have been at lunch somewhere down the road. I mean, there were people around, I would say, and that's the thing is you would think that somebody would have seen something, but nobody saw anything. There were no real witnesses to the crime. You know, it's just sheer dumb luck, unfortunately, it was opportunity and that person took it. So the first search warrant was for the apartment and then also for her fiance's Volkswagen Golf. He had nothing to do with it, but you always have to rule out, especially somebody that's close to her. They lived together. He found her. So they had to at least investigate to rule him out. And they didn't believe that robbery was a motive because nothing appeared to be missing from the apartment. Among the items collected as a result of that search warrant were knives, sink drain traps, 18 blood samples, and 23 swabs for DNA. So I think, again, taking knives from the residence would be a way of ruling out that the fiance may have done it, or possibly determining whether or not the assailant could have used a knife from there to commit it. So it would speak to whether or not they brought that, right, if they brought that weapon with them, or if it was something that they just grabbed there and took advantage at the time. So it kind of speaks to motive as well as premeditation to some degree. Four search warrants were filed in connection with Thomas Cosgrove, a man who was retroactively jailed for carrying a concealed weapon after he and other presumably homeless men were found sleeping in Vilas Hall on the UW-Madison campus. So I think that particular area, there were a few homeless people that were around. And so they thought once he was found, with a concealed weapon, that maybe he could have been a potential suspect. So they had some search warrants that they had filed against him. Two of the warrants sought surveillance video from the FedEx Kinko's on the corner of West Washington Avenue and Regent Street related to the same man, and two others were for clothing and personal items. So those were the four search warrants that they issued against that particular individual. Another warrant sought DNA evidence and a photograph of Jeffrey D. Ball, who was considered a suspect after he threatened to stab a Butler Plaza employee upon being discovered sleeping in a woman's bathroom. And police found a bloody knife in Ball's possession days after the Zimmerman homicide.
A bloody knife in his possession.
Yeah, none of that panned out though. So they, I think these
were out of all of those juicy options, not one panned out.
Wow. Well, and I think it's more that like these arrests or occurrences happened in close proximity to it. And so because these homeless men or vagrants who may have been in the area of the crime had weapons on them, they did the due diligence to rule them out as potential suspects in the case, but none of it actually resulted in anything. Essentially, they ruled them out. And a final warrant sought a DNA sample from Chauncey A. Mack, who witnesses reported was bragging on State Street about stabbing Zimmerman. So you've also got the cuckoos that want to take credit for something like that for some reason, even though it's horrible. But DNA evidence ruled him out as well. Despite the various leads identified through the investigation, the case went unsolved for years. 8 years after the murder of Brittany Zimmerman, her parents came forward to share that there was a new DNA evidence in the case. Police had made a match to DNA left at the scene, but at the time didn't have enough confidence in the case from an evidentiary standpoint to make an arrest.
So this is 2016?
2016.
Okay.
Brittany's parents, understandably frustrated over her seemingly identified murderer continuing to walk the streets, couldn't just sit back and do nothing, which is why they decided to go to the media. If police had sufficient confidence in the DNA as evidence in and of itself, probably an arrest would have been made, but an arrest wouldn't come for years yet after the DNA match actually came through. I mean, as a parent, I would be tearing my hair out. That is where you get vigilante justice.
Yeah.
The perspective of a parent who lost a child and an investigator who has to follow the law and make a case that can go to trial can be vastly different. Unfortunately, that appeared to be the case with the investigation into Brittany's case. It started with the botched 911 call and culminated in a DNA match that police didn't feel was sufficient to make an arrest. Follow that up with a missed opportunity for information from a would-be informant, and you have a rather tense situation. The informant who came forward and claim to have information on the case, you know, had a criminal record and was only interested in sharing this information in exchange for charges being expunged from his record.
Of course.
So essentially, the police deemed it as not credible or probably lies just to try and get something for it. But as a parent whose child is murdered, you have a DNA match, and this person is saying that they can connect the crime or have evidence to connect the crime to the person who they match their DNA, you're willing to deal with the devil to get whatever information you can to, yeah, to finally put a killer behind bars. So their perspective on this is very different. Police were unwilling to make a deal, and that same informant ended up dying in a motorcycle accident like a year after coming forward initially. So no one will ever know what they may or may not have known. So the police think there was no truthful information to be gained, but Brittany's parents felt it was a missed opportunity.
And I guess I can see both sides of that. I mean, cops are trained to kind of sniff out bullshit, and they obviously had a strong feeling, but from the parents' perspective, I mean, like you said, they want whatever to just go ahead, but do you want to let somebody off the hook for charges or whatever? Yeah.
And I think part of the problem too at this point is that I don't know that they had a whole lot of confidence in the police, at least at this point in the case, because of everything that had happened before then with, you know, with the way that the 911 call was handled, that really started it off on the wrong foot. And then all these leads, and I think the police may have even made promises that ultimately they were unable to keep by having it solved quickly. And so, you know, here they are still 8 years later. Now you got a DNA match and you're telling me you can't do anything with it. Like, I would be, you know, at that point, your confidence in the police are probably so low that, you know, you don't necessarily trust their judgment in saying that this individual doesn't have valid information.
Yeah, I'd be pissed. I mean, if I was the parent.
Right. Madison police refused to consider Brittany's case a cold case, but her parents said not doing so was actually unfair to Brittany. As long as her case was considered active, the police would not be inclined to share their investigation files with a private investigator.
Yep. They can't close. You can't get anything from the cops until the case is considered closed. And cold would be, I have to deal with that all the time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
After 10 years with no arrests, the Zimmermans wanted new eyes on the case. So they wanted to bring in a private investigator. And again, this goes to the fact that they didn't have the confidence in the police, but the police still considered it an active case and wouldn't classify it as a cold case. So the Zimmermans were stuck waiting for the police to make their case.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah. So add another sticking point between the Zimmermans and the Madison Police Department.
So for a cold case, let me just make sure I'm understanding this. It's not like after 5 years, after 8 years, after a designated amount of time, 20 years, that it automatically gets reverted to a cold case. It's basically the police department saying, okay, now we're going to make it a cold case.
I think it's once they've gone through and exhausted every lead that they've gotten in a case, then they would have the option to say the case has gone cold and we're going to close it. But I don't think that there's a time limit specifically. I'm unaware of one anyway.
Wow. I guess I just assume that after a certain amount of time, it gets closed and called a cold case. And then there's some detectives that at some point are going to come across that case and try and dive into it again. Okay.
Yeah, and that does seem to happen in a lot of cases, but I think especially with this happening, it just got so much media attention. I think they just continued to work it as much as they could. And in a way, they probably felt like the department had a bit of a black eye, so they had something to prove. So they weren't about to make it a cold case and say that they were giving up on it. They're going to keep working it. But
true, that would have not gotten the greatest publicity.
Right. Yeah.
And Madison at that time did not have, I mean, it still doesn't have a lot, not compared to like Milwaukee, but Madison, they didn't have a whole lot of homicides. So there probably were detectives that were still at least attempting to work on it.
Yeah. Let's go back for a minute to the DNA match that was made in 2016. Despite coming forward to the media, her parents didn't reveal the identity of the killer, but ultimately made no difference. So they did want to get the story out there and let the public know that a DNA match had been made, but they at least knew enough not to release the name of that individual, even though I believe they did have that information from the police. But ultimately, the reporters were able to fish it out anyway. So it was revealed that the DNA matched a man named David Call. The specific DNA found at the scene of the crime that was matched to David Call was DNA found on the sleeve of a shirt that was worn by Brittany Zimmerman on the day of the murder. At the time the news story came out about the match, David Call was serving time in a Wisconsin prison, having been convicted of a 7th OWI charge.
Holy shit. Wow. 7?
Yeah.
Wow. Damn.
Well, maybe if we had harsher laws against OWI offenses, he wouldn't have made it to 7.
Right, right.
You know how much money that is? Jesus. Just the financial aspect, let alone the jail aspect, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I don't think he was paying anything, which is why he was in jail. But so this allowed investigators to learn more about their suspect and initiate contact without having to worry about him going anywhere or hurting anyone else, at least for now. So I think we've talked about this a little bit with other cases, in that they'll either try to get the suspect on another charge so that they can get them in prison to buy more time to investigate, or if they're already in jail, they will take their time in building their case because they don't have to worry about them going anywhere.
Yeah. So they either try to get them on tax evasion, or they try to, what's the gangster that got caught or whatever for.
Right. And yeah. So I think there was an element of this there, because when they just making the DNA match, especially having so much time pass between when the crime occurred and when the match was made, they needed more evidence to substantiate that his DNA couldn't have been there from some other reason, that there couldn't have been some other form of transfer of DNA. And so while the parents saw this as, you have a match, why aren't you doing something with it? I think they were doing something. They were taking their time to build a more solid case before moving on him for this particular offense. And him being in jail made it easier for them because they didn't have to worry about him going anywhere. So a little bit about David Call. What they learned as they started to learn more about him was that he was not the kind of man you'd want your child encountering. David Call was, in fact, a registered sex offender. He was convicted in 1993 of a second degree sexual assault, not to mention other various convictions, including the 7 OWI charges. When confronted with the DNA match, Call has said he was at a crack house close to Brittany's apartment and admitted to being in her home that day, but says he didn't kill her.
He just sounds like a peach. Gosh.
Well, and
trust a guy that comes from a crack house.
Crack house.
Goes into a stranger's house, but, and there happens to be a dead body turn up, but he didn't do it.
He's like, this isn't where I parked my car, but I didn't kill her. What?
So his story is that she is one of the people he and other drug addicts approached for money, and that she gave him a glass of water.
Yeah, I invite crackheads into my house all the time.
Right, right. Oh my gosh, please.
He said, I can't remember if I shook her hand, gave her a hug, thanked her for loaning me the money.
Yeah.
Loaning the money or giving the water? He's already contradicting himself.
Right.
He's trying to explain away the DNA.
Right. How it would have transferred. Sure, yes. Oh, I gave her a hug, or she gave me some money, gave me some water. He insisted the other men he was with were going to go back to rob her. But if you'll remember, there was never any evidence of robbery. They didn't believe it was robbery. So if other men had gone back to rob her, and they're, based on what he's trying to imply, the ones that would have attacked and killed her, there would have been signs of a robbery. On Friday, March 20th, 2020, David Call was finally arrested and charged with the murder of Brittany Zimmerman. So it took 4 years after the DNA was initially matched before they finally arrested him.
What was the date?
March 20th of 2020.
Yeah, so right after the world closed.
2 days before Roman was born.
Oh, wow.
The world Wisconsin basically shut down on the 15th of March.
I think it was the 25th. But
everything was already closed for St. Patrick's Day, and that's the 17th. I was already working from home by then.
Yeah, I think the official state shutdown was the 25th.
Yeah, actually, the official one, that does make sense.
Yeah. So on March 20th, or in March of 2020, David Call was 53 at the time of his arrest, which would have placed him at about 41 years of age at the time of the murder. David Call was charged with first-degree intentional homicide as a party to a crime and by use of a dangerous weapon. It wasn't entirely clear as to what changed to result in Call's arrest at this time, but the complaint associated with the arrest says that in April of 2019, authorities took a letter out of evidence and had it tested for DNA. In August of 2019, they learned that Call's DNA matched the DNA found on the seal of the envelope. The letter received by authorities in April of 2009, so this is that letter, 10 years before, had a return address of Fox Lake Correctional Institution and indicated it was from an inmate who said he overheard another inmate discuss being involved in Zimmerman's death. So there's some details in this letter that added some support for him being the attacker. The criminal complaint goes on to say that Call was in Zimmerman's neighborhood at the time of her death and had been knocking on doors and asking people for money, saying he needed to fix a flat tire. One witness said he even...
should he be driving?
Who knows if he even had a vehicle? Wait, no, that's right. He did get arrested for OWI at some point. Well, but this was...
7 times, so should he be driving?
No.
He should have a license.
One witness said he even came into her house to ask for money, and she told him to leave. So he is definitely... I mean, there's a thread of truth, but I don't know that he's being invited in so much as pushing his way in and then being asked to get out. So I would say that witness probably got pretty lucky that she wasn't the one attacked.
Yeah, for sure.
Call was interviewed several times by police over the years. At times, he told them he was high on crack cocaine and was working a scam to get money. And he also said he was a paranoid schizophrenic who wasn't taking his medications. Yeah. He mentioned
a drunk driver.
Right. He mentioned being with other people and told different versions of what he remembered about going to Zimmerman's house. So story kept changing over the time. In 2008, he allegedly told a fellow inmate that he was worried his fingerprints would be found on Zimmerman, including around her throat. And again, you have to take any information gained from other inmates with a, you know, you have to vet it or take it with a grain of salt, because, you know, usually they're trying to benefit in some way as well. In 2014, he told police he believed the people he was with were responsible for Zimmerman's death. So again, that's going back to that story that he and a group of other guys went asking for money and that they were the ones that went back to rob her or harm her. With the arrest, police said they didn't give up their search for justice for 12 years, conducting hundreds of interviews and processing countless pieces of evidence. Over the years, her parents have repeatedly asked anyone with information to come forward, and there have been rewards ordered offered in this case. The dedication and persistence of those tasked with investigating this case, past and present, has never wavered, police said in a statement. So I think, you know, very much they were trying to right a wrong. You know, they didn't handle it great in the beginning, especially with the way the 911 call was handled. And I think they were, you know, in their, while the relationship with the Zimmermans was strained, I think they really wanted to be the ones to bring justice to them and to their daughter. And it took 12 years, but they were finally able to make that arrest. So while David Call has been arrested, the case still needs to make it to court. After medical expert testimony, David Call was ruled competent to stand trial in June of 2021. And a preliminary hearing to evaluate whether or not there was enough evidence to go to trial took place in July of 2021, a month after he was ruled competent, and resulted in David Call being ordered to stand trial. So they did actually go through the process of determining whether or not they felt there was enough evidence even to like make it through a trial. And there it's for the judge. So as of March of this year, the trial has been set for early next year, with jury selection starting January 17th of 2023.
Can you even imagine being the parents? I mean, at least they're getting some kind of information regarding what happened, but the fact that, you know, it kind of started in 2016 and was hanging over their heads, and then up to 2020 or 2018 and then 2020, and still like no trial until 2023. My God, that's a long time to wait.
That's crazy.
And the original murder was
2008.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it, she was 21, she was getting married. It's been 14 years. They very well could have had grandchildren by now if this hadn't happened. You know, I think part of it is you're mourning the loss of life, you know, with Brittany, but you're also mourning the life and lives that could have been.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
It's a constant struggle. Every day you're living that and thinking about it and what could have been. And the longer it drags out, the harder it is to finally, you know, obtain some level of closure.
Right now there's such a backup with all the courts because of COVID. So that's likely why it's pushed back so far, because criminal trials, you know, that it normally, I don't think, would have taken that long to get in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you are, you know, should have right to a speedy trial, but unfortunately it is what it is.
Yeah.
But at least he is arrested and he's behind bars, so he's not doing anything useful while he waits.
And he's in Madison?
He might have been in Oshkosh, might have been where he was actually in the correctional institute. I think part of it depends on if he was still in jail at the time that they made the arrest for this particular case and where he was serving that time. But so to kind of add a little bit more around like the personal impact, because I had mentioned that I had this case in mind even from the start, always in terms of wanting to cover it, because I was in Madison going to school when this happened. So I definitely heard about it. But even more than that, my maid of honor, Rachel, which you guys all know, she was my roommate in my junior and senior years in college. And Rachel was a medical microbiology and immunology major, same as Brittany. And they actually had some classes in common. And I believe, I'd have to confirm this with Rachel, but I'm pretty sure that Rachel was in the same exam that Brittany was returning from when she went to her apartment that day.
Oh my gosh.
So in addition to this being a huge news story on campus, this particular connection meant that this was definitely something that we talked about and continued to talk about as the years passed and it still wasn't solved. Senior year, my college boyfriend also lived with us. And while he was very smart, he didn't always have the most common sense. And sometimes
common sense is uncommon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Seriously.
Okay, Dad.
It's true though.
Sometimes he went a little too by the numbers. And in particular, Rachel and I often argued with him over locking the apartment door and would reference this case as part of our argument. Like we wanted. His thing was that, like, if one of us were home and somebody else was out doing classes or whatever it was or wasn't home yet, that we would be fine leaving the door unlocked because apparently it was too much of a bother to get your key out and unlock the door. And we're like, no, we're not going to leave the door unlocked. It's like, we're going to lock the door. Like, what are you talking about?
So glad
he got kicked to the curb.
Eventually, yes. Well, when you're in a lease, it gets complicated. I didn't. That absolutely did not. So,
you married into a way better family.
Yeah. Well, and I say like he went a little too by the numbers. His argument was that the odds of somebody breaking in were small, and he also,
oh my gosh,
still. Probably will still want to make it a little harder for him.
Oh my gosh.
And he would actually say, now this one is going to make your jaw drop, I think. He actually believed that if somebody were going to kill us, they would not only have to have a reason, but that they would tell us what that reason was before they did it.
Wait, this is what your boyfriend is saying?
That's what he said.
Come on.
Well, okay, so that makes it okay that you could be like, well, no, that's not true, so don't kill me. I mean,
well, but yeah, so we're like, no, that's not how it works. I said, like, in some cases, sure, you might know your assailant and they may have a motive, but not everybody needs a motive. Some people are just messed up individuals, and this is a case where a stranger had ill intent and broke in and attacked her. And That's why we're like, this literally happened like 2 years ago and it's unsolved and is the perfect reason why we should at least lock the damn door. Right. And it was, you know, so there's a reason why he and I didn't make it past college.
But you made it through the lease, right? That's what's most important.
we I toughed it out. That gets complicated when you're on a lease together. But
yep,
he definitely made it longer than he should have, because he also once told me that if we were ever to get married, that he would be the one making all the big financial decisions because I was too emotional.
Stop.
Well, I hate to say
one happened to the other, first of all.
This was not the 70s, was it?
Emotion have to do with financial decisions. Well, oh my God, that refrigerator. I'm so emotional. I can't make a decision. Like,
I'm apparently a too emotional, frivolous female, so I can't make sound decisions. I mean, technically, you know.
Oh my.
There are different ways of making decisions, but yeah.
I'm just going to take a gander and assume that this guy is married and since divorced.
I don't know. Honestly, I haven't cared enough.
He's got a divorce under his belt. Well, now I'm more curious about this guy than, you know, the trial, the upcoming trial here.
Yeah. But as a tangent, I do digress, and to get us a little bit back on track, I mean, again, this case was, well, he was too stubborn to see our side of it. This particular case was the perfect example of how a stranger with no good reason could commit such a horrific crime. You don't need a reason, like at least not one that normal people or, you know, good people would consider to be a valid reason. So even now, I always lock my doors. Even if I just let the dog out, I always lock the door behind her. And we live in a more rural area. I mean, we do have neighbors, but it's like not, definitely not the city, definitely not Madison. I mean, the odds are even more minuscule here, but I don't give a shit. I'm locking the damn door.
I'm always locked in, and people say, why do you bolt lock yourself in? I'm like, because I'm in there. Like, if I'm not home and the doorknob is locked and it's not bolted necessarily and they want to go in, that's different. If I'm in here, I'm going to make it even harder. Like, they can take my shit if they need it that bad, but I don't want to be in here when they do it.
Yeah. Right. So as Georgia and Karen from My Favorite Murder say, lock your fucking door.
Yep. And fuck being nice. Isn't that the other one?
Fuck politeness.
Fuck politeness. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I got to learn that one. I'm still learning that one.
Trust your gut. I don't think would be the big thing. If somebody is coming off as a creep, but you're afraid of like being rude, that's where you'd be like, okay, trust your gut above the politeness factor. If they seem like they're nice and they're not coming off as a creep, then I guess you can all play the odds, but trust your gut.
I was going to say, like, if this guy seems like he definitely just came from a crack house, like, I'm not going to invite him inside for a glass of water, you know?
Right.
I think I have some
instincts, you know, to cut that back.
If a guy comes up to you with an injury asking for help, no.
Hey, Ted Bundy.
Right? No.
That's right. Yeah.
Nope.
Like, hey, can you help me carry my canoe? Like, there's 50 men around. Why would you ask me? Like,
right? And he snatched two women.
Right. That day. Same day.
Anyway. So Agarwisco High Note is also actually related to this case. So I do want to kind of, while the case still has some activity and closure to be had, I think the parents of Brittany have at least been able to move forward. And they did take this particular event and try to funnel it into some positive activity. So following the crime, her parents set up an annual 5K run walk in Madison area with proceeds going to support a local charity group called Madison Area Crime Stoppers, the hope being that it would eventually lead to the arrest of their daughter's killer. And since the arrest of David Call, the annual run walk has been given a new name and a new location and a new vocation. So now it is actually known as Pause for Brittany, and it takes place in Marshfield, Wisconsin, which is where she's from.
Pause as in P-A-W-S or P-A-U-S-E?
P-A-W-S. So okay. Pause for Brittany is a fun run and dog walk in memory of animal lover Brittany Zimmerman. So it starts in the Wildwood Park in Marshfield. It starts and finishes in the Wildwood Park in Marshfield. So it looks like the first time they may have done this was in 2021, but they do actually, it's coming up in 2022 as well. So I think since now they have made an arrest in the case, they're taking the, they're still doing kind of the same thing, but they're funneling it towards something more geared towards something that's Brittany.
Yeah.
Loved, and also with the connection to her hometown. So the benefits, or the funds raised, benefit day-to-day operations at Marshfield Area Pet Shelter, or MAPS. So Marshfield native Brittany Zimmerman was attending W. Madison when she was attacked and murdered on April 2nd of 2018. Brittany was an avid animal lover and advocate. And bringing comfort to Brittany's parents, Kevin and Jean Zimmerman, are Brittany's three beloved cats, Marvin, Felix, and Boo.
Oh, I had a Felix.
So we have chosen MAPS to keep Brittany's memory alive because animals were such a huge part of her life, said Jean. She supported many shelters herself, so it made perfect sense for us to continue this. So this is what they have done. So initially they were trying to do something for charity, and initially it was funneled towards solving her murder, as well as helping other crimes in the area. And now their case has been solved. They're kind of bringing it closer to home and closer to something that Brittany herself loves. So there is a 2022 pause for Brittany. And that's actually set for May 7th. And again, it's the Marshfield Wildwood Park and Zoo. So it says here,
this comes out in time.
Yeah, I don't know if it will, but you actually, registration would have had to have been complete. What does it say? Registration must be received by, well, actually, I think people can still register, but if you wanted a t-shirt, you would have had to have registered by April 23rd. But so Pause for Brittany is a 2.3 mile fun run and dog walk that starts and finishes in beautiful Wildwood Park and Zoo in Marshfield. The event takes you around the upper pond, past buffalo, elk, wolves, and other wildlife. Pets and strollers are welcome. This family-friendly event for all ages benefits the Marshfield Area Pet Shelter. Funds raised from this event helped care for hundreds of homeless animals in the community Brittany grew up in. So it's at least something positive that was initiated and is, you know, continuing to go on year over year.
Yeah, that's awesome. Totally understand why they would want it moved to their hometown and pick a different charity.
Mm-hmm. I think it's part of that closure of being able to move past the crime and looking more towards something that Brittany loved, and she loved animals.
Something more positive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that,
shall we say positive?
Positive.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay.
That's what I had for this episode. That's what I had for the case.
Yeah, I don't know why I remembered because she was in college and engaged. Like, for whatever reason, that was one of the things that I remembered, because it was abnormal for somebody,
yeah,
21, yeah, a junior in college and engaged in Madison.
Well, I think she was actually going to be graduating that spring. So I feel like she was actually graduating early, possibly. Either that or she just was young.
That's what I kind of remember.
Yeah.
Be graduating soon.
Yeah. But she did want to become a doctor. So she certainly had likely had more schooling ahead of her. But it was certainly a big milestone to get that first degree and get married and start a life. I mean, she was just starting.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely, I mean, some of the details are fuzzy, but it's something I will never forget. It was definitely a big hot topic when I was in school. I mean, I'm sure any parent who had a kid going to school heard about that. It's immediately, where did that happen? How close is that to me? Like, do I have to be worried?
I remember we were checking in with you.
Yeah. I moved to Milwaukee in 96, and within weeks of me moving, there was a homicide in Madison on University Avenue. And I remember it because it was like the first homicide in Madison in like 9 years or 11 years or something. And I moved in August of 96, and then coming to Milwaukee, and they were on like their 130th murder of the year or something. And that's when I realized, I thought I grew up in a big city, and all of a sudden I found out that Madison is basically just a small town and Milwaukee is just a normal sized city and Chicago is a big city. All the things I learned moving to Milwaukee.
Yeah, my hometown's even smaller. But, well, I think we'll get another case on the docket. And I think pretty soon we'll be looking to do another Wisco Crime Beat. A couple more news articles, get some more voices out there with the podcast. Mix it up a little bit.
I think before Erica ends the podcast, I just want all of our listeners to be sure to listen to the absolute complete end of the episode for the Jill. Will you do it with me?
I don't know if
the moo,
the cow sound.
Never listen to a podcast all the way to the end, because normally it's just like little dinky music or there's an ad or da da da. And literally, the podcast that I am on, I heard the ending of it for the first time and was like, "Oh my gosh, there's a cow mooing at the end." It's pretty funny.
It's a Wisconsin podcast. You have to have a cow.
I know.
But yeah, so anybody who's listening, who's stuck with us through this, if you're not already doing so, please follow us on Instagram at Beer, Cheese, and Murder Pod. Subscribe or star or favorite or whatever it is, the podcast and whatever app you're listening on. Give us a rating, help us be more easily found by other people's interested in true crime. Share it.
I rated us last week. I had forgotten to do that. So
yeah,
I hope you gave us a good score.
I did. I'm pretty proud of us. I like us. So I gave us a 5.
Yeah. Yay. If you're listening and you like us too, share it with your friends, your family, a random stranger on the street. Shout it out.
If you don't like us, too effing bad. No, I'm just kidding.
If you don't like us, you don't have to listen. It's that easy.
I can't believe you said sure with a random stranger on the street.
Erica, we're trying to steer away from that. That's why murders happen.
You can shout it across the street. Like, you don't have to get close to them.
Like, don't invite them into your house after you tell them about it.
I'm going to go over to Kayla's for dinner and just yell out through downtown.
Yeah, everyone on the Riverwalk and on the river, all the rowing team will be like, what?
Everybody's got different comfort zones. I wouldn't do it, but if you're an extrovert and you like, we'll just put it out there, do it. I don't care. But yeah, just get the word out, share it with friends, share it with family, or whoever you're comfortable sharing it with. And
but while you're doing it,
until Erica. Next time, eat, drink, and be wary.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. We would like to also thank the references that make this podcast possible. A full list of references can be found on our website at beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at beercheeseandmurderpod, where pictures from today's episode are available for your viewing. If you would like to share your feedback, WISCO facts, case suggestions, stories, or just whatever, please email us at contact@beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Don't forget to tell your friends, but most importantly, until next time, eat, drink, and be wary.